So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
The Hulk's gotta come out of it. If not, it's over for the Hulk.
This is what did it to Berkman. He's got it on and he's got it applied tight. He's got those fingers interlocked. Only the immense power of the Hulk could save him. Starting to shake. He's got to reach down inside for that little something extra. Look at, he's powering his way up. He's made it to its knees. That takes the effect away from the hole. Hulk Hogan now stands up with a Sheik and rams it into the top turnbuckle.
Fans are going wild and I'm so excited.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting with you. How are you doing today, Wei?
Doing pretty well.
You've got some water?
Water, yes. H2O.
H2O.
Which I learned this week from Damien Sandow.
Yeah, I guess you could either have drank that or, I don't know, had something to do with Abraham Washington.
No, George Washington.
Yeah. All these fucking Abraham
You would have
Lincoln,
failed.
George
you would
Washington.
Have, you would have failed
I would,
that
I would have thing. Been stumped.
Oh, man.
I know what you're thinking.
Yeah.
Video. I watched it, too. Our pal Shane.
Our pal Shane.
Probably shot by our other friend, Braden.
Yeah, they decided to enter the tout challenge.
If you want to see this video, go follow Braden at Joker Radio. I'm sure he's got it posted on there.
Yes, and I'm sure.
I saw your retweet. So wrong.
There's no way it's ever going to make
You don't think it will?
No way. I don't think so.
Probably not.
Yeah.
I went out today just to grab a drink before our podcast, and I went to the convenience store nearby. It began raining. Just got totally caught in the rain. Bought my Rockstar energy drink, and I then
those things will kill you.
Maybe. I put it in my pocket, got back to our office, came upstairs, got back here, went to take it out. Nothing in my pocket. It had fallen out somewhere along the way, so I had to retrace my steps. It was in the where we walk in, the back entrance. It was on the floor there. There's like three people just looking at the map, so I don't want to just go down there as they're like avoiding this drink that's just lying there, and I don't want to be like the guy, hey, look, free drink. I'm just going to steal it, so I had to wait for them to leave.
Come on, really?
And then I took it. So look how banged up this thing is.
Yeah, but you have to wait for these strangers to leave before you can go retrieve your drink that you bought and paid for?
I would feel awkward. I also would be the awkward one who, if it's like I dropped a loony or something on the floor at a club or something, wouldn't want to be the one to just notice it and then go to pick it up.
What?
Yeah.
Why not?
It's just – it's like maybe the guy's going to say, hey, that's mine or
– No, you – It was yours. I mean, maybe if it wasn't yours, yeah, you would feel that way. But you know in your heart that this was your property. You just lost it.
Well, I got my drink back. Rockstar energy drink?
No, well, I think you could be safe. I mean, who's going to pick up one of those? Who's going to pick up a random drink from the ground and drink it?
That would be a stupid decision, I think,
yeah,
for anyone to make. So that is what is fueling us for this historic edition of Review Away. The first event, Way, that we are going to review that predates us. I usually ask you, were you watching at this time? Or were you, what were you doing? What was happening in Wei Ting's life? This is irrelevant.
Yeah, I was in my mother's womb.
As was I?
Yeah.
Amazing that we were born so close. Five days apart.
That's right. You March 9th, me on March 14th.
And this January 23rd.
Yeah. So I guess I would have been, I don't know, like 7 months. I would have been a fetus. Does that qualify as a fetus? There's embryo and there's the fetus.
I guess it would depend which political party you're with that right. would determine how much of a life you were.
Wow.
7 months, that's pretty deep.
Yeah, I don't think there's a chance they'd go back on it.
No second guessing at that point.
Yeah.
Waiting's coming out.
No, I'm out. I'm here.
I am here.
But I don't think my parents were watching this event at the time, so I wasn't able to enjoy this from my mother's womb.
So this was different. Is that the best way to describe this show? Different?
Well, I
no,
sure.
Like, other than a ring, there was like so little connection to today's product. Like, and great, it's 28 years. Obviously, there are just night and day, though.
Yeah,
the presentation, everything was different.
A lot was different. Absolutely, the presentation, mainly for me. You know, just as a TV guy, that's what I noticed more. But I will say, a lot of the maneuvers, a lot of the gimmicks that we see guys employ in the ring, the basics and the fundamentals are still there today. Everything they do to play to the crowd, to try to get heat, to try to, you know, get reactions.
Heat for some of these matches.
Absolutely.
Some huge.
And it's important to note that it was a very different type of crowd, too. It was I found this MSG crowd to be, and I guess mainly a lot of 80s crowds to be just, obviously, it wasn't, kayfabe was still very,
intact,
yes, at the time. And people just really seemed to believe that these bad guys were bad guys and the good guys were good guys.
So this was the monthly Madison Square Garden show that the WWF would hold in front of their New York crowd, obviously very much a Northeast-based territory at this point, and then would begin expanding more. After this time period.
And by this point, where in the WWF's history were they? Vince McMahon Jr. had been in control for how many years?
I believe about 2 years at this point.
At this point, okay.
And this is really the introduction of Hulk Hogan after he'd been brought in through, they had taken him from the AWA. Gene Okerlund had come over. David Schultz, they were about to pluck, who would debut the following month at Madison Square Garden. So it was certainly kind of cherry-picking from a number of different territories their big stars. And that was one of the keys of the expansion territory the expansion period for the company is that they were taking top guys from all these territories and essentially almost creating like this dream team territory where you had, man, Roddy Piper come in, who was just a manager when he was brought in. His original role was simply to replace the Grand Wizard, as they would always have three managers, so like with Blassie and Albano. And once the Grand Wizard left, they thought Piper would fill that role. And instead, Piper just got over so huge. And as you can see on this show, was really in a manager role that they'd eventually put him in the ring because he got so over, and that would lead to Bobby Heenan coming in. But they were just going all over the country and selecting guys that they could get and bring them in, and some just stealing them from territories if they could.
And in terms of TV, were they on anywhere outside of MSG, outside of the New York area?
They didn't have, obviously, the USA Network deal at this point. USA Network was around at this time, and they actually were running wrestling prior to WWF wrestling.
But I guess my point is, at this point, it was still very much a New York territory.
Absolutely, absolutely. And these shows, they would typically, if they had a big enough card where they'd sell out Madison Square Garden, they'd open up the Felt Forum, which was like a 4,000-seat arena, basically adjacent to Madison Square Garden, where you could watch on closed circuit.
Which they did for this show.
Yes, they did. And this was obviously a very anticipated match with Hulk Hogan challenging the Iron Sheik. He had just defeated Bob Backlund December 27th, I believe, so less than a month prior to this. And so essentially getting the title off Backlund and then preparing for their next babyface, which was interesting way because they did have the title on Superstar Billy Graham for like a year, but it seemed that Vince McMahon Jr.'s idea was always having the babyface champion, and you could compare that to the NWA, where it was throughout the 80s, kind of the heel, whether it be Harley Race or Ric Flair, it was the heel that would just escape with the title versus the babyface hero conquering the heel as kind of the predominant theme.
And it seems like both have their merits and both seem to work tremendously.
So we start off, we've got Gorilla Monsoon and Pat Patterson doing commentary for this show. Not the most legendary duo.
I really didn't know Patterson did any commentary.
Yeah, back here, yes. He was, I don't know.
I didn't think he was bad.
He wasn't terrible, but...
He was a little quiet, maybe, at times, and this wasn't, you know, certainly not... Didn't have the dynamic of, like, you know, Heenan and or Ventura and Gorilla. Passable, though.
Howard Finkel, front and center here. For these Madison Square Garden shows, welcomes us to an all-star night of professional wrestling. Professional wrestling? What's that?
Isn't that what they called it?
Sports entertainment. What is this wrestling stuff? And this was right out of a fucking UFC event. He ran down who the judges were at ringside, the medical physicians, the timekeeper, and this was when the New York State Athletic Commission would oversee pro wrestling.
Well, watching this, honestly, it reminded me of watching a UFC show in terms of the way it was presented. It was just basically presented like this was a real sporting event. Everything was very formal. No fireworks, no flashy graphics.
Really, no music for the most part.
Yeah, just an announcer out there announcing the rules straight up, and I was waiting for him to tell me who the ringside judges were.
Is it weird to go that here we are reviewing this week, and this is the same company who last week we reviewed an angle where a man tried to climb into a dumpster. It exploded, and then he was buried alive by his brother and died on pay-per-view.
Sure.
This is the same company.
Involving the same people.
The same guy that booked this, booked that match.
It is really quite amazing how much pro wrestling has evolved. Well, in particular, between the time here, 1984, until 1998. And that was only really, 14 years. 14, 15 years. And that's another thing that really struck me, too, watching this show. The evolution of pro wrestling between that period, 84 to 99.
Yeah.
Comparing, let's go 15 years back from today, 2012 back to 98, 97. There's almost no evolution at all. You can take a show from today.
It's an hour longer.
Put it right next to a show from 97, and it's almost the exact same thing. It really is amazing how little pro wrestling has changed and how much it changed back then in that same amount of time.
Or even like a lot of the characters that we were talking about in 98 still around today, most of them still wrestling today.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine if we were still seeing Tiger Chung Lee and Tony Garea in the Attitude Era.
Yeah, it's amazing. You couldn't think it. I mean, Tony Garea in a backstage role, yes, but as a senior citizen, basically here, like the thing, you know, we saw Vader just a couple months back this year, and he seemed out of place, no doubt. But I could totally buy him showing up on Impact. You know, like we still see Hogan wrestle. We still see Sting wrestle in prominent roles. So, yeah, just interesting.
Opening up the card was the aforementioned Tony Garea against Jose Luis Rivera.
Never heard of this guy.
Exciting start here to the show. And there was just a constant headlock and head scissors counter. They do this three times in a row, and they built up to the big high spot of a shoulder block by Rivera, and then an O'Connor roll for a near fall. Garea bends over as Rivera goes for a drop kick, totally misses him, and the fans boo this obviously fucked up spot. And then Rivera comes off the corner with a cross body. Guerrera flips, lands on top, and pins him. The announcer called it at 7 minutes and 48 seconds. I didn't have to time these matches because Finkel did it for me. However, this first match I did time, and I will say there was a minute 3 difference in the announce time.
Wow. So
they had this annoying thing where they had the most annoying bell that they used at this point. Like, ding, 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 ding. And they would do it like four times before the match would start. They would do it for the intros. They would do it after the intros. Well,
it's like a boxing fight.
Yeah, and then they do it again when the match officially began.
Right.
So well, you got to get the. It was the identical bell, yeah, that they had for Cotto Trout the whole card.
So, yeah, yeah, and maybe that's a, better, analogy. The boxing to me is even more formal than you know MMA presentation. Boxing, I think the presentation of boxing really hasn't seemed to change. I don't know in what 50 years, and you know it was very much like this was very much molded. I'm assuming after boxing matches of the time. What you immediately notice about the match is that you know these guys are wrestling very soft but very technical styles. There's nothing that they do that looked stiff at all. Just a lot of counters, a lot of roll-ups in this match. Everything looked very safe and technical, which is not to say it was bad. I think in fact this is what wrestling mainly should be. It should just look. I mean, it should. You need to throw a bit of realism in there. You can't have it look too soft. But I was impressed by the amount of technique employed by these two.
I don't think that Chaos and Scar were watching old WWF Madison Square Garden tapes.
No, they weren't.
Imagine they were doing this in the backyard. O'Connor rolls and shoulder blocks.
I wonder what backyard wrestling back then looked like.
Backyard wrestling in 1984.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Abdominal stretches.
A shoulder block. Crazy.
We go to Wei's favorite wrestler, Tiger Chung Lee, teaming with Mr. Fuji to take on the Invaders.
I don't know. I've never heard of this guy, Tiger Chung Lee.
Oh, yeah. He was a regular here.
He's a regular? Oh, God. Tiger Chung Lee. Like, could you come up with a more stereotypical Asian name?
Tiger Chung.
Chung, your name is Tiger. We're going to name you after some. I'm assuming there are plenty of tigers in that part of the world.
An Asian tiger.
Take that. Yeah. And you're. What's a. What, let's clink these pans together. What's the sound that they make? Chung Lee. There you go.
Chung Lee Wong Lee.
There you go.
Everything.
Tiger Chung Lee.
And Mr. Fuji. Referee here was Jeff Bartfield, and Gorilla cites the ominous salt-throwing ceremony by Tiger Chung Lee and Mr. Fuji. If you folks have never seen Mr. Fuji wrestle...
I have never seen Mr. Fuji wrestle.
He's terrible.
Has he always been terrible?
Yes, he's always been terrible. I would venture to guess he's always been terrible. Invader, one of the Invaders, punches Fuji in the gut, and he takes just the funniest-looking bump off of this... punch to the chest. I can't imagine landing on my back if Wei were to punch me in the stomach right now.
Why not?
The physics of it. I don't think if you punch me in the stomach, is someone going to jump and land on their back? It's just not going to happen. I might fall to the ground and wince in pain.
Very powerful.
But I'm not going to take a back bump off a shot to my stomach. Come on here. Then there was another strange spot. As one of the Invaders, he just leaped over the top rope, then back to the outside of the apron, then back into the ring, and then back out. And that was all he did.
No, that was the idea, is that Monsoon explained, these Invaders, they do stuff like that to distract the referee.
Terrible idea.
I thought it was kind of neat.
I can see the guy. I know if he's going to switch or not. The referee was staring at them. He wasn't confused.
No, you're distracting the referee... I don't know why, because they're baby faces, and I don't know.
Well, they built up to a big spot as one of the Invaders caught Fuji, tossed him off the top, and then made a hot tag to Invader number two, and then they crowd into number two, who's attacking Lee. Monsoon outs number two and calls him Johnny Rivera at one point. Oops. And Lee cuts him off with a back suplex. Tiger Chung Lee applies a bear hug to number two that number one breaks up. They build to a hot tag to number one. He gets beaten down as well. The Invaders double team and attack the left leg of Fuji and build up to the abdominal stretch. And then they Irish whip Fuji and Lee into each other. They do the robot, the rowboat spot as the time limit expires. Man, these two teams went 20 minutes and 21 seconds, according to my watch, as the Invaders think they won, but is it? But it's announced as a draw.
Yeah, this match was way too long. I understand that the Orient Express. I guess their style is to be slow and methodical. But it was too much, and too much time was given to this match, and a lot of the matches on this show.
20 minutes of a Mr. Fuji match.
But I suppose maybe at the time, people were more used to longer matches. I mean, you know, we're watching this through 2012 eyes, where we only get probably 3-4 minute matches on a weekly basis.
Listen, I have no problem with long matches, but this was just... not an entertaining.
Yeah, no, it was shitty. It was very long, very slow. But I did find the Invaders in-ring quite entertaining.
I looked up some of the shows WWF was running back here in 1984, and they would do television tapings in, like, Hamburg, Pennsylvania. It'd be, like, their one-month television taping. There were 24 matches
on
this television taping. Imagine watching 24. We watched, like, 8 here.
How would you, like, in how long would these matches be? I'd assume, like, around approximately 7 minutes each.
Sure. They had to fill all their TV for the month or so.
Wow.
Yeah, you just hear stories of these marathon TV tapings back in the day, and I can't imagine sitting through these. Up next, no backstage angles or anything here. No AJ,
yeah,
no love angles.
No hidden camera.
Aces and eights or, I don't know. No hands being given birth to. Even though, did you know, Way, the hand, Mae Young's hand, happened in Madison Square Garden.
Oh.
That's where the birth took place.
Wow.
The masked superstar, Bill 80, under a mask, taking on Chief J Strongbow. And Monsoon calls this a main event in any arena in the country, except this one. This was third match in. Monsoon refers to this as the best wrestling in the world. I think the NWA would have a lot to disagree with. And believe me, you watch this style. Like, if I was a kid watching and I had the NWA and WWF, there's no way I'm watching this over the NWA at the time.
Mm.
I mean, talk about different in-ring products. Completely different in 84. Strongbow goes after the mask of Superstar, but then he runs to the floor, finally returns to the ring, and Strongbow does his war dance that the crowd responds to, attacks with knee lifts, goes after the mask again, and Superstar hits him with a back elbow, comes back with a sleeper hold onto Superstar, and then escapes, hits him with a clothesline, and Superstar Bill 80 wins this at 7:18, as Monsoon notes that clothesline could maim someone.
Maim someone.
Maim them.
Okay. I thought this match was not technically great by any means, but I thought they told a good story of, you know, Strongbow trying to take the mask off. And for his part, I thought Strongbow played a very strong baby face here, eliciting really good crowd reactions. And, you know, what stands out to me is that you look at a guy like Chief J Strongbow. Look at that physique. That marvelous physique on Chief J Strongbow, and there's no way he'd make it today. Yet, the reaction that he managed to get from the crowd, it really doesn't matter what you look like. You just need to be a good wrestler who has his timing, who has, you know, who's able to wrestle and be able to tell a story, basically. And, you know, that's what I kind of got from watching this and this show.
And then there were other wrestlers who it did matter what they looked like. And out comes Ivan Putski.
Ivan Putski, yes.
Boy, were people excited that knew that we'd be reviewing this show. And Ivan Putski.
Yeah.
The father of Scott Putski himself here, reviewing a show with Father Ivan.
Father Ivan. And if there's any doubt that this man... is
passed on the S gene.
Yeah, is a Scott Putski father. You just need to look at him from the neck down, and you'll be able to tell. Because he is by far my leading candidate for the Scott Putski Award. Perhaps the first time a man will win an award named after his son in history of any award.
Any sport, any entertainment outlet,
yeah.
I can't think of any.
Yeah.
So Ivan Putski, certainly a candidate. And believe me, there were a few candidates on this show. Ivan Putski, he looked like a Photoshop picture where you've placed the head onto someone ridiculous.
You're right, because his face was kind of like old-looking. but his body was very...
Very protruding.
Right.
So his opponent, Sergeant Slaughter, comes out. First one to have music on this show, gets a full entrance. And Sergeant Slaughter was very over babyface here in 1984.
And at what point did he, where did he develop this character? Was it in the WWF or was it prior?
No, I believe it was, because he had been in the NWA prior to this. He had been, I believe, in the AWA prior to this as well.
Slaughter is a guy that really stood out to me amongst this group because he seemed like one of the people with a fully formed gimmick, a fully formed character, complete with an outfit, I guess a backstory and whatnot. But then you compare him to guys like Ivan Putski, who's just, you know, this regular guy. I mean, albeit a very massive, muscular man, but just a guy with trunks and no real flair or gimmick to him.
Pat Patterson here making some production notes, marvels at the camera work as we were able to see the reflection as the cameraman zoomed in on Sergeant Slaughter's glasses. And we got, look at that camera work. We can see the reflection those glasses.
Is
that a bit of a trick of the trade way to get someone's reflection if they have glasses on?
No, not really. It's really just science and I don't know.
They decided to have a pose off. Putski, certainly the more in shape of the two. And we saw a headlock by Putski as Patterson explains that Putski has a beer every now and then and that Putski also likes to sing. I would have loved to have heard Ivan sing a little here. Slaughter gets knocked into the post and is bleeding and keeps sending him into the turnbuckles and crowd gets into the match here. Slaughter catches him with a clothesline as Putski comes out of the corner. And he calls that the cannon. And he goes for a scoop slam, but Putski lands on top for a two. This was like Hogan slamming Andre, only it was Slaughter slamming Ivan Putski. And Putski then hits his Polish hammer and shoulder blocks Slaughter to the floor. Putski sends him back into the ring, but the referee calls for the bell at 11 minutes and 26 seconds. Putski sends Slaughter into the corner, goes over into the floor, and continues the post-match beatdown of Slaughter. And Finkel announces that Slaughter has won by countout.
Both men were very over. Putski, I thought, was very over as a babyface. Slaughter over as a heel as well. There's a good dynamic between the two, and the both of them got really good reactions from this crowd. But for me to watch this with my 2012 perception of pro wrestling, it was just so hard. This was so dull and so slow.
Gorilla Monsoon then had to throw to Gene Okerlund and just butchered this throw. Now we'll go to the back with...
Right now, let's go back in our locker room interview area with Gene Okerlund, who's going to interview Mr. Wonderful Porno Orndorff.
Polo Orndorff or something. Call him like Paulo Orndorff or something.
Paulo.
It was just not the best Gene Okerlund or Gorilla Monsoon throw in history. So this was Orndorff, his first match at Madison Square Garden, and Orndorff cuts a promo on Italians like Sal Bellomo, who he's going to be taking on, says he doesn't like Okerlund, and he's better than these people that make $500 to $600 a week, and that's what he makes in 2 minutes, and promises to hit Bellomo with the pile driver. The funny part I took away from this, making fun of people making $500 a week, is that that was what the standard offer was for developmental talent in the WWE, to make $500 a week. I don't know if it's changed since then, but that used to be the rate.
Wow.
So there you go.
Back in 84, you mean?
No, like in 2004.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So $500 would have been a lot more in 1984.
I guess.
Yeah.
Paul Orndorff with Roddy Piper taking on Salvatore Bellomo. And Piper complains about the knee brace on Bellomo, and they just teased forever, leaving the ring, tons of stalling. And then finally, he gets attacked from behind as Piper distracts Bellomo. And Piper sells huge at ringside, complains about the count. Bellomo gets a two count after falling on top. Orndorff then misses him in the corner and hits his shoulder into the post. Bellomo hits a standing drop kick. Crowd got behind his comeback here as he went after the left arm of Orndorff. Bellomo eventually gets sent to the floor in front of Piper. Orndorff slams him on the floor and then stomps on Bellomo in the corner. And Bellomo comes back with chops, fires up. Orndorff is selling big here, but then runs into a power slam for a two by Orndorff, and then he hits the spiked pile driver and pins Bellomo 14 minutes and 5 seconds, to which Patterson notes for Bellomo, "I give him an E for effort." And the post-match saw Piper and Orndorff beat down Bellomo as the referees tended to this a journeyman enhancement talent in Bellomo.
An E.
E for effort.
Do they give E's on report cards?
I guess maybe he just meant E, the letter E, starts effort. I have no idea what Patterson
was going. The G for great.
Yeah.
Well, what does that mean?
A for astounding.
W for wonderful.
B for banana.
I thought this match was good, despite the very, very slow build. And they really took their time doing that. But it really helped to accentuate the parts where they did wrestle very fast. And certainly it really helped get the crowd going for the faster finish. I thought Piper was a lot of fun to watch ringside, just yelling and, you know, doing his whole shtick. And the other thing I noticed was that the miking of this production, the crowd seemed to be miked very well, but they didn't have any mics in the ring at the time. So these guys would be throwing punches and kicks and slamming people on the mat, and you wouldn't really be able to hear anything. These days, they, of course, hang a microphone above the ring and who knows where else.
We then continue onwards to our next match for the Intercontinental title. Don Morocco taking on the Pistol Firebird, Tito Santana. And Lou Albano is in the corner of Morocco. Title look completely different here at this point. Morocco comes out in a red hoodie, and they cut to a fan in the crowd wearing a red hoodie. I guess in support of Don Morocco, the red hoodie gang. Very slow start. Santana applies a headlock.
Oh, man.
And what a headlock this was.
The baby face.
Patterson starts talking about psychology and Santana asking the veterans to watch his matches. And there appeared here to be a chant of Tito sucks in the crowd. And the headlock just lasts forever.
Yeah.
Forever.
This would get booed right out of the building. Like, if this was like the UFC, the ref would just stand him up for this headlock being way too long and being way too ineffective.
So the headlock continued. And Santana, if he ever lost his grip, would go right back to this headlock. Morocco finally gets up and starts attacking Santana. Santana hits him with right hands. Albano comes into the ring, gets knocked to the floor. Santana fires up, goes for a flying forearm, but misses and runs into the turnbuckle. Santana stops Morocco on the top rope, and crowd, hey, they started really slow, but when this built up, the crowd was with them here.
Yeah, I'm sure that was the intent at the time.
Yeah, absolutely, and hey, it worked. And the bell is called as they fight to the floor, and Morocco gets knocked into a table, grabs the title and exits, and they rule it is a double disqualification at 16 minutes and 3 seconds here. So it picked up.
Yeah, for as much as we complain about these matches being too slow, what really matters in the end is just these crowd reactions. And for the most part, all these matches towards the end of the match, these crowds really do react. So I think it really is, a product of us being removed from the time that this product was being shown.
And that was a feud that would obviously continue past this show. Okerlund is in the back with Santana. Tito complains that it was an early stoppage and blamed bad officiating and wanted a decisive finish.
Mm-hmm. Not the best promo from Tito Santana. But
he was a 1984 babyface. And then, way, we go to a special attraction. The Midgets are in town.
The Midgets. And you're not being politically incorrect.
No,
at least not to them, because that's how they described it.
Yes. Haiti Kid and Tiger Jackson against Dan Carpenter, even though he's Key Dana Carpenter here. I think it was Dan Carpenter. And my favorite, Poncho Boy. In a 2 out of 3 falls match.
4 outstanding midget wrestlers in the world today, as Finkel tells us.
Poncho Boy comes out from Montreal, and I'll give you 3 guesses as to what he was not wearing on the way to the ring.
What he was not wearing? Jeans.
He was not wearing a poncho.
Oh.
How can Poncho Boy not wear a poncho?
I don't know.
That's like T-shirt man coming out topless.
Right, or maybe like sign guy without a sign.
I mean, the name is Poncho Boy. The fuck?
Maybe, I don't know. I have no explanation.
I don't understand this. Patterson says, I like the midgets. They are entertaining. Poncho gets pantsed by Jackson here. Carpenter comes in, slaps the head of Tiger Jackson to mock him. Saw flying head scissors by Jackson to Carpenter. And then Jackson does a headstand in the corner, gets spun around, and then Jackson with a sunset flip powerbomb to Poncho to get the first fall. Then they did the classic pile on the referee spot. They did the crisscross spot.
Which the crowd loved. The crowd reacted huge to
all this
comedy.
Look at these little people running around so fast.
Yeah.
There was an airplane spin to Carpenter. Then Poncho hits Haiti Kid into the gut for a two count. And then the finish just comes out of nowhere where someone gets pinned. The announcers were just as confused here. And Monsoon says that the ref must have gotten knocked in the head. And this ended so abruptly. And they just cut away to an Okerlund interview. This got fucked up.
Somebody seemed to fuck up. And Monsoon just basically called it, you know, didn't try to hide it at all. This ref must be drunk. Let's cut to the next segment.
That was
basically it. A very lackluster finish. But I thought the match itself was a really nice break in the middle, in the third quarter of this long show, really. I mean, the short people, they provide very good comedic relief. And you know what? These guys, they're actually quite talented. To be able to pull off a comedy match, I wouldn't say is that easy to do. In fact, in many ways, it's probably harder to do than an actual wrestling match. And I thought these guys did a great job. And, you know, in terms of pacing on the card, are really really effective to have this comic relief in the third quarter of the show.
So from there, we continue onwards and go to Okerlund with Freddie Blassie and the Iron Sheik. Okerlund calls Sheik on the fact that he can speak English, and Sheik basically admits, yes, you're right, I can speak English. Mentions that he is an Olympic champion, calls Hogan an animal, and Okerlund just cuts the promo short and throws it to the ring, saying, we're out of time.
He can say maybe about the same 10 words in English. It's the same shit that he's been saying today, even. This promo sounds exactly like his interviews today.
So we've got the Iron Sheik, accompanied by Blassie, defending his WWF title against Hulk Hogan.
Yes, and the what was the reasoning behind putting taking the belt off of Bob Backlund? How long had Bob Backlund been champion in the company?
Oh, Jesus. Backlund had it for a long time. I believe he won it in 70... I want to say 78.
Okay, a very long time.
Yeah, he had quite the reign.
And what was the decision to basically put the belt on the Sheik as a transition to the Hulk?
I think they just didn't want to do the babyface program. And the idea originally was that they were going to take the title off Bob Backlund, and then they wanted Backlund to turn heel and work with Hogan, and he would have to dye his hair. And Backlund was like, fuck this.
Dye his hair?
He'd have to dye his hair black. He's a heel.
Really?
And Backlund would not go for this.
And instead he decided to leave the business.
He left the business as a result.
Huh.
And I think he did probably some shows here and there, but it was largely out of the spotlight. Yeah, I'm just looking here. Bob Backlund, he won the title from Billy Graham February 20th, 1978, and had some brief, dropped the title to Antonio Inoki for like a week, which WWF no longer even recognizes, then won it back, and basically held it until dropping it to the Sheik. So you're talking about a significant reign here from February of 78 until December of 83.
Yeah, that's almost 14 years.
Yeah.
Or sorry, 16. No. 16 years.
No, no, no. 78 to 83, that's like 5 years.
Oh, oops.
But still long.
I'm proving stereotypes wrong.
Anyway. That's Wei Chung Lee, everybody. So they dubbed in Real American here for Hogan's entrance.
Yeah.
As people pointed out online, a song that had not even been produced at this point.
Were the U.S. Express not using it at this time?
I don't think the U.S. Express was in the company at this point. So
okay.
Yeah, Rick Derringer had not put together this song yet.
And I guess they didn't want to pay the rights to Survivor.
Yeah, probably not. The heat for this match was unreal. This sounded like whatever big fight you can cite. Like, this crowd was just amped for this match. Mm-hmm. Like, they were so into this. It was very obvious how over Hulk Hogan was as a star at this point. And a lot of people look at this as, you know, when Hulk Hogan really broke onto the scene. I mean, a lot of people fail to realize that Hogan was a pretty big deal before he got to the WWF. There was a reason they went after this guy. He had already been in Rocky. He was the top babyface in the AWA, and they just never wanted to pull the trigger to put the title on him at this point. I mean, he came in with a lot of a built-in of a fan base. It's not like he just started from scratch here when Vince McMahon signed him. And Hogan attacks Sheik at the bell. Place just erupts, is choking Sheik with his robe, spits on the Iron Sheik, to which Monsoon notes, "The fans love it. He's spitting on this foreigner." Hmm. And Hogan hits a knee drop, big boot for a two count, misses Sheik in the corner, who then gets the brief heat here, stomping on him as the crowd just sounded insane. And then he applies the Boston Crab. Hogan breaks it and suplexes him. And then Iron Sheik applies the Camel Clutch, which has never been broken. Hogan gets to his feet, breaks it as he rams him into the turnbuckle. Again, fans just pop huge for that. And then Hogan hits the leg drop and pins the Iron Sheik in the grand total of 5 minutes and 40 seconds, knowing how to book this guy. And wins the title.
Yeah, it didn't need to be any longer.
No, this was perfect.
This whole building was just on fire. And in the ensuing moments, we see the shot that, you know, they keep replaying anytime you see a history package. This gassed and winded Hulk Hogan holding that old circular WWF heavyweight title. And really, one of the major moments in pro wrestling history that I'm glad we took the time to watch.
And this would begin his 1,474-day title reign.
Wow.
That'll go until February of 1988. So, amazingly, and something I legit did not know, this wasn't even the main event on the show.
Yeah, I was surprised.
Now, what they usually would do would put something on big before the intermission, and then they'd come back and announce the main event for the next month's Madison Square Garden show, so you could buy tickets at intermission, and then you'd put on something later here. So I don't know if they took an intermission here or what they did. But anyway, that was one of the thought processes they had of putting something on big before the intermission here.
We should also get to the backstage celebration.
Yeah, they go to the back, and Okerlund is in the locker room with Hogan, who cuts a promo about being on top of the mountain, citing that there's 20,000 to 30,000 people who just watched this, and said that the title partly belongs to Gene Okerlund and all of the people.
It was really awkward, I found, here in this promo when he said, "Hulkamania is running worldwide, and it just turns me on, Mean Gene."
It turns him on.
Yeah.
And then Andre walks in to pour champagne on him, kind of your top attraction, kind of endorsing the guy mm-hmm. who the WWF is running with. And then you had Ivan Putski and Rocky Johnson as well, part of this celebration. And then they announced to us that we have two more matches to go after this title change. Starting off with Rene Goulet against Jimmy Superfly Snuka.
How are these guys expected to follow?
This was the women's match, really. And Jimmy Snuka was really over at this point in time, but in a death spot. Goulet just stomps on his sternum. Monsoon says there were 6 to 8 matches tonight that would fill any coliseum in the world. I disagree. Goulet applies the claw to Snuka, who gets up, hits him with a headbutt, a leapfrog that the crowd oohs at, and then hits a big chop, climbs to the top, hits a crossbody from the top, and gets the win as Gorilla Monsoon says, "Good night, Irene." A call that has been since taken over by one Michael Schiavello.
No, that's right.
And Snuka, he gets the win and just walks off. Doesn't stay to celebrate, raise his arm.
He's
nothing.
Like, fuck this. You expect me to go out there after you guys put all that
brother
out?
3:54 was the time of the fall.
Yeah, very Snuka. Quick, nothing match.
Yeah. Gene Okerlund, we're back in the locker room. Hulk Hogan is with his parents, Pete and Ruth. Ruth, clearly where Hogan got his promo ability from.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't Pete.
Absolutely. The mom was a pretty decent talker. Dad, not at all. His dad's like, he's like, "What the hell is this fake stuff my son is into? I wanted him to be a doctor or something."
Hogan then cuts a promo on how important Pete and Ruth are and says their names twice. Who calls their parents by their name?
People who, I guess, maybe have a strained relationship with their parents.
Let me tell you about Pete and Ruth. They're the reason I'm here, brother.
Yeah.
Pete and Ruth.
I will say they did a tremendous job of making this title win seem very important, which I really think is lacking in today's wrestling. I mean, when was the last time we saw a post-victory, title victory promo even? I understand that they these days they kind of like to save it for the Raw right after, but I think there's just such an energy after a guy just wins his title for him to cut those classic promos. I mean, remember like Flair after the Rumble, or in this case Hogan. I just think that that's something they should bring back.
I couldn't help just watching this whole celebration and thinking, this is the guy who now is dealing with a sex tape scandal.
Yeah.
This is the same guy.
We all have our skeletons.
I guess so. And then the main event way. We had tag team champions Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas. If there was going to be a contender for Scott Putski nominees, I thought Tony Atlas really stood out as well.
I'd say Tony Atlas, Rocky Johnson as well, and Jimmy Snuka. But
yeah.
But I think if I had to make a choice, I just love
it. I think we are somewhat voting with our heart, though.
Yeah.
And they are teaming with Andre the Giant, taking on the Wild Samoans, Afa, Sika, and Samula, for the future Samu from the Head Shrinkers.
Samula.
Samula.
It's a bit, it sounds like, yeah.
Maybe that's where they got Manu from. They just took a... I don't know. Samu, Manu. I still think Manu is one of the best wrestling names ever. It's just a ridiculous name.
It's probably his real name, isn't it?
Manu?
Yeah.
No, I don't think it was.
Oh.
Samula was only 20 years old at the time of this match.
Well, I was wondering, because he actually ended up staying quite a bit longer in the WWF than the other people on this card.
Yeah. Well, he'd leave for a while, too. He'd be in part of the Samoan SWAT team and then come back. At one point here, Afa is standing on the apron and just puts his hand in front of the camera. You notice that spot?
Yeah, I like that. I thought that was cool. It's like,
why? What's he trying to hide?
Because he doesn't want his
televised.
No. Samu was getting beat down in the other corner, and he wanted to block the camera so that people wouldn't watch it. I thought that was kind of funny.
This happens as Samula applies a full Nelson onto Atlas a few minutes later, powers out as he makes a pose. And then they double-team Andre when he gets tagged in. Afa continually headbutts him, but Andre no-sells the headbutts, and he headbutts Afa, who lands on his back, hits a big boot, and basically just sits down on Samula for the win at 4 minutes and 56 seconds. Crowd files out as Monsoon and Patterson close the show, and we go to the credit roll.
The credit roll, yes, which I don't really miss. I don't really care who made this show. Not much of a match here, and not... It just really seemed like these two matches were of completely no consequence whatsoever after seeing that Hogan-Sheik win. And you know what? For that matter, almost none of the matches on this show are really of any consequence outside of that one main event, Sheik versus Hogan.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously a historical show based on the title change, but overall as a show, I'm still giving this one a 4 out of 10. I thought the heat was incredible for Hogan and Sheik. And you know what? I'm never one that is going to necessarily say something is bad because you don't have A-level workers. I mean, Hogan and Sheik controlled that crowd.
Yep.
Every second they were in front of that audience. It was an awesome atmosphere. I couldn't imagine what it was like being live there for that match.
Yeah, if there's something that watching this show taught me, it's that you can get a crowd hot over pretty basic things, which I think would still work today. You don't need to have, you know, sex scandals and table matches and all that. It's just, you know, basic storytelling, I think, can go a long way. So it was fun to watch.
This was, though, extremely basic. Like,
yeah.
This was, like, a lot of this, I wouldn't even say stuff was bad. It was just, a lot of it was just boring. Like, a 20-minute match, that killed me, that time limit match. Just killed me that I watched Mr. Fuji for that many minutes in succession.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree. Don't torture yourself over that. I also give the show a 4 out of 10.
All right. Well, let's see what you had to say, folks. This was up on YouTube, so you did have the option of watching this, should you dare to. And we start off with Danny Hernandez, who writes, "So this was the show that started the machine we now know as the WWE. This was not a bad show by any stretch, as there was some good psychology and fundamental ring work. I really enjoyed the real sporting event feel that MSG had, plus having two former wrestlers like Monsoon and Patterson calling it helped too. For some reason, I really liked the Mr. Fuji Tiger Chung Lee tag match. It could be because I can't picture Mr. Fuji being anything other than Yokozuna's manager. Who knew that Slaughter was a better bumper than Dolph Ziggler, and Ivan Putski needs to work more on his legs in the gym? Even in 84, the WWE title is still in the mid-card. Talk about no respect. But in July of this year, when Moolah lost the women's title, Hulk Hogan's title matches were still in the mid-card for some reason. Must have been a slow build till WrestleMania next year. Finally, were those really Hulk Hogan's parents? Yes, they were. Good show with a lot of older workers. Thank goodness HD did not exist, because the close-up to Chief Chase Strongbow's face. Overall, I give this show a nearly six-year title reign out of 10. Well, I explained the reason they put him on in the mid-card, because you couldn't announce next month's match until Hogan had wrestled, because he would be the main attraction for the next month. So they wanted to wrap that up, set into motion what his program would be for the match next month, and that's why they would do them in the middle of the card.
I see.
So it was done with a business reason behind it.
Chris in Ottawa, that sweet 30-second MSG Network signature at the beginning of the show totally got me in the mood for some big, slow 80s wrestling. I had no idea Mr. Fuji used to have such beautiful hair, and holy crap, Sheiky Baby's boner. I'd read once that steroids can cause involuntary erections, but to see one in one of the most famous wrestling matches of all time is rather shocking and quite the period piece. Even though Hogan would have entered to Eye of the Tiger at this show, could you please play the 1985 classic Hulk Hogan's theme by Meatloaf composer Jim Steinman to close out Review Away this week?"
Absolutely.
Next, we go to Chris Engler. "It's the little things on these old shows that make them worth going back to. From the Atari logo on the scoreboard, the stripped tube socks coming out of the top of most of the wrestlers' boots, Don Morocco's form-fitting red hoodie, and Pat Patterson calling Gorilla Vince during the main event, this was a very entertaining walk down memory lane." I missed that.
Our next piece of feedback. "Just a few notes. Jose Luis Rivera versus Tony Garea was a terrible opener. Blown spot as Garea ran the ropes, and as Garea bends over to deliver a backdrop, Rivera comes off the ropes with the drop kick. It looked pretty ugly. I found it odd that the WWE title was not the main event, but I guess Andre was a bigger draw. In his book, Bobby Heenan told the tale of how Hogan and Orndorff main evented two nighttime shows in one night after they wrestled in the first half of one show. Hogan, Orndorff, and Heenan all boarded a private jet without even changing clothes, flew 500 miles, and got a police escort to rush them to the second arena where they just made it as the last match of the night. So I guess Hogan didn't always main event. I also heard the reasons for putting the WWF Championship at the middle of the card was because they often announce exactly what John said. Overall, as a standalone show, I give this 4 Iron Sheik boners out of 10. Wow.
Let's go to Vince from Vaughn. "Watching this made me feel 4 years old again. Surprised to see Hulk wrestling like a heel, though. Hitting Sheik from behind, choking him with the robes, spitting on him, all seems pretty dirty for a babyface. I enjoyed this card mostly for the nostalgia of seeing a bunch of guys I haven't seen since the final days of the UWF." He forgets, though, the rule that if it's a foreigner, especially at the height of the hostage situation, there is no heel tactics against a man from Iran in the WWF.
Mm-hmm. Christian Small, "When during the opening match you get a replay of a roll-up, you know what kind of show you're in for. To be honest, I don't mind the show, and the only part that dragged was the Fuji Tiger versus Invaders match. But that does bring me to the problem I had with this show, and that was the finishes. We got a time limit draw, a heel count-out win when they were only on the apron, a completely random double DQ, and a referee screw job in the midgets match. But this show had many highlights to me, the first being how loose the ropes were. I also really loved Slaughter's work as well as Roddy Piper as a manager. And let's not forget the amount of bells there were. Not that you could.
That wasn't the only one.
They were endless, it seemed. They really loved that bell. Overall, I quite liked this show, but that might be due to how awesomely 80s it was."
All right, on to Simon from the UK. I've watched this up to and including the Slaughter match. I must say I've really enjoyed the event. I don't really watch much wrestling these days and consider my main viewing years to be early 90s and early 2000s. A bit like Way, I missed the glory years. What I liked about this MSG event is the sporting aspect. It had a realistic feel. I also felt that the work rate was much higher than I expected. Slaughter was bumping like crazy. Also, I loved the camera work. It offered a fluid but inclusive angle at the same time as protecting the work of each guy. How amazing was it to have the father of Scott Putski on the card? Not only that, but Monsoon and Patterson talk constantly about how he was fat and got himself into shape so quickly. Interesting. He gets my vote for the Ivan Putski Award. And I think he has officially won the vote.
Yeah, I think so too.
Finally, we go to Ed Davis, who says, I think it was this match that officially put wrestling in the homoerotic genre. I know you guys don't want to talk about it anymore, but the Sheik, a notorious gay slur perpetrator, got a chubby while jiggling around with the soft skin of the Hulkster. How ironic. I wonder if Hogan put on cologne before the match. The Iron Schlong should have held the title for longer than a month. I mean, come on. It's pretty cool how Hogan won the first title from the Sheik. Such a perfect illustration of the 80s. Like leg warmers and headbands, keyboards and boomboxes, and cheeseburgers and choo-choo trains.
All right.
I did not pay as much attention to the Iron Sheik's packages. It seems like many people have.
I did not notice this, but I'm glad so many people did point it out. So yeah. Such an interesting part of WWF history was the Iron Sheik's erection during the title change.
I guess so.
There we go. That was all the feedback. So thank you very much to those of you who posted on the Law message board as we went back to 1984. And Wei, we look ahead to next week, and we're going to change things up with a unique review we have planned.
We've thought about doing this for a long time, but we're just kind of confused about the
logistics.
How
we're going to do this?
Yeah. Because John and I were not really avid video game players, but nonetheless, we've gotten a lot of requests, and we do have a promotional copy lying around the office. So next week, we are going to review the much-talked-about WWE 13 video game.
Yes, and I think we'll try and focus around the Attitude Era mode, because that seems to be what everyone is talking about as the real highlight of the game. So we'll play around with it. Wei's going to take this thing home and go nuts on it, and I'll add what I can as well. And we may be joined by someone from THQ as well next week, who actually knows what he's talking about.
Right, right.
And can answer questions from people like myself and Wei Ting and your feedback.
When was the last time you played a video game, a wrestling video game?
Years.
You were a big No Mercy guy, but didn't you try like that?
I tried a Raw versus SmackDown game, and I played it for 20 minutes and got frustrated and didn't play it anymore.
Right.
I just didn't like it. Didn't get used to the controls.
Okay. Well, we'll see how this goes. We might even start filming some of it. But
I think we are. I think they want to put a camera in here when we play it.
All right. Well, and I know a lot of you guys have this game. You're playing online and whatnot. So we're expecting a ton of feedback. So please be something about the feedback, too. If we're getting a lot of it, try to be as concise as you can and read through some of the other ones and just, you know, make sure that you're not repeating things that other people are saying. So
yeah, and I think we're going to try and keep this as much as we can to WWE 13 because I know this can easily kind of go into other video games, which I would like to do sometime in the future. Like if we were to go back and review like an N64 game that I really can talk about better.
Right. If this goes well, it might open the door for a lot more reviews like that. But I look forward to it. Anytime I don't have to watch a fucking 3-hour show from 1984.
Wei loves these weeks.
Yeah. No, but I look forward to playing some video games and maybe we'll even play as ourselves.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. So that's coming up next week here on Review Away. We'll be back later this week, Friday morning, with Review and Impact with Nate Milton, Wei Ting, and myself. This Sunday, The Law, midnight Eastern time with Dan Lavransky, Jason Agnew, Dave Meltzer, and we'll be chatting with Greg Oliver and Steven Johnson, who have just written the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame Heroes and Icons book. Just a massive encyclopedia version of just a look at just about every wrestler you can almost imagine. So it's a really well-done book that I'm currently making my Wei through. So that's coming up on Sunday. And in the meantime, join the Law message board. It's lawradio.proboards.com. You can always leave your feedback there and interact with all of us. And Wei is on Twitter, at way0937, at I am John Pollock, and we will chat with you all later this week. And we need some music to go out to, so are we going with that request?
Well, let's go out to what Chris in Ottawa suggested, and that is Hulk Hogan's theme from Meatloaf composer Jim Steinman back in 1985.
All right, that's the music I hear, and that is what we will go out with. Chat with you all in a while.